This year, I am focused on saving and investing, but I still want to do things like travel. NerdWallet lets you compare top travel credit cards side by side to maximize your spending, some even offering 10 times points on your spending, which means you could end up with a free flight or maybe a better hotel room.
So what could future you do with smarter financial decisions? Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. NerdWallet, finance smarter. Reminder, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply. Eating processed food for every meal isn't healthy for people or for dogs. We all know that. And kibble is subject to multiple rounds of high heat processing, making it an ultra processed food. The Farmer's Dog is real, fresh, healthy food with whole meat and veggies gently cooked in human-grade kitchens to preserve their nutritional value. My dog, Barnaby, loves the Farmer's Dog. When he sees me pulling one of those packets out, he comes running. It's personalized, vet-developed, and it has recipes for as little as $2 a day. Meals arrive in pre-portioned, ready-to-serve packs, and they're conveniently delivered on whatever schedule works for me.
Get 50% off your first box of fresh, healthy food at thefarmersdog.com/happier. That's 50% off your first box at thefarmersdog.com/happier.
Hello and welcome to Happier, a podcast about strategies and solutions for making our lives happier, healthier, more productive, and more creative. This week is our discussion for the Happier Podcast Book Club. So we will be talking to author Anne Patchett about her terrific novel, The Dutch House. I'm Gretchen Rubin, a writer who studies happiness, good habits, and human nature. I am in my home office in New York City, and with me is my sister, the sage, Elizabeth Kraft.
That's me, Elizabeth Kraft, a TV writer and producer living in LA. And Gretch, I'm in my home office in Encino, and I cannot wait to talk about The Dutch House. I loved it so much.
Yes, but before we dive into The Dutch House with Anne Patchett, I want to put a spotlight on a Black author this week, Trevor Noah. Now, many people know Trevor Noah as a comedian and as host of the TV show The Daily Show on Comedy Central. And he also wrote a fascinating, brilliant page-turning memoir called Born a Crime.
Yeah, I'm listening to it, Gretchen, and it is so good.
Yeah, it's so good. Now, it was a number one New York Times bestseller and was named one of the best books of the year by the New York Times, NPR, Booklist, etc. So this is not a book that has not been heard of.
Yeah.
But it's one of those books that really, you're like, eh, is it really that good? And yeah, it really, it's thought-provoking, it's hilarious, it's poignant, it's deeply moving about what it was like to grow up in South Africa under apartheid. It's about his relationship with his mother, about his friendships. It's about so many things. I just loved it.
Yeah, I loved it too. And I love listening to it because he has a South African accent. So it just adds to the experience.
Well, and one of the things that's very striking is he speaks seven languages, and he talks often about how the ability to speak someone's language allows you to reach people in a way that you can identify with them and understand them just because you can talk to them, which is fascinating.
Yes.
There's one line I just want to read because this has just struck me so hard. So he's talking about all the things that his mother did to show him a bigger world, which was not easy under apartheid to like introduce him to all these different experiences and environments beyond their township of Soweto in South Africa. And he writes, "We tell people to follow their dreams, but you can only dream of what you can imagine. And depending on where you come from, your imagination can be quite limited." And so he writes about all the things his mother did to give him a big imagination and a big dream. So it's just a terrific book. So yes. A spotlight on Trevor Noah and Born a Crime. And now for the book club. Last year, we launched our Happier Podcast book club, and today we will be talking about the brilliant novel, The Dutch House by Anne Patchett. Anne Patchett is an internationally best-selling author. I love all her novels, especially Bel Canto, Commonwealth, and State of Wonder. I also love her essays. I do love essays, and that's called This is the Story of a Happy Marriage. Perhaps most of all, I love her memoir, Truth and Beauty, which is about her friendship with the writer Lucy Greeley. And I also love children's books, and Ann Patchett has also written children's picture books. She has one coming out in September called A Scapegoat, which is illustrated by Robin Price Glasser, who, if you know Fancy Nancy, as one does, she is the illustrator for Fancy Nancy.
Ann Patchett has also won the Orange Prize, the Penn Faulkner Award, and a Guggenheim Fellowship. If all that isn't enough to keep her busy, she also opened the beloved indie bookstore Parnassus Books in Nashville, Tennessee. Her latest novel, The Dutch House, has generated a huge amount of buzz. It has been a big bestseller and was named a best book of 2019 by NPR, Washington Post, Slate, Library Journal, and others, was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize, and was a New York Times Book Review notable book. Here's the description. The Dutch House is a richly moving story that explores the indelible bond between two siblings, the house of their childhood, and a past that will not let them go. It digs deeply into questions of inheritance, love and forgiveness, of how we want to see ourselves, and of who we really are. The story is told by Cyril's son, Danny, as he and his older sister, the brilliantly acerbic and self-assured Maeve, are exiled from the Dutch House where they grew up by their stepmother. The two wealthy siblings are thrown back into the poverty their parents had escaped from and find that all they have to count on is one another. It is this unshakable bond between them that both saves their lives and thwarts their futures. Set over the course of five decades, The Dutch House is a dark fairy tale about two smart people who cannot overcome their past. Despite every outward sign of success, Danny and Maeve are only truly comfortable when they're together. Throughout their lives, they return to the well-worn story of what they've lost with humor and rage. But when at last they're forced to confront the people who left them behind, the relationship between an indulged brother and his ever-protective sister is finally tested.
So welcome, Anne.
Hi, Anne.
Hi.
Thank you so much for doing this, especially in these strange times. But it was such a pleasure to read this book.
Oh, thank you.
And we loved hearing from everybody about it. Everybody loved this book. And one place to jump out in is The Dutch House is the title. It's such a huge theme. So Sophia asked, was this inspired by a real house? And Kim asked, I once read an article about Ann Patchett's own house and the care and love they put into making it a home. As I listened to The Dutch House, I wondered if that process showed up in The Dutch House in any way. So what is the history of The Dutch House?
Those are two interesting questions. It's funny because I would definitely say, no, there is no Dutch House. There are pieces of mini houses that I have been in over the course of my life that I put into the Dutch House. What was important to me was that the Dutch House would be the house that the reader remembered. Mm-hmm. You know, that I feel like everybody has a house either that they lived in or their friend lived in or they drove past or they went to a party there and they thought, that is the most magnificent house. Like, that is the house of my heart. I interviewed Reese Witherspoon for Vanity Fair, and I went into her house, which was in Nashville. It was the most astonishing house, and it really got me emotionally. And she said, this is the house that when I was in high school, the other girls lived in this house. And, like, this was the house that I dreamed of when I was a teenage girl, which since Reese and I both went to girls' schools in Nashville, I got it completely. Even before she said it, I was like, this is the house I wanted when I was 16. So I was trying to go for that kind of feeling. As far as my own house is concerned, no, I mean, my house is not the Dutch House. I am somebody who likes to clean. And I am very big into house maintenance. I take very, very good care of the place that I live. So there is probably a house tenderness that I brought to the story.
And what about, Anne, the sort of control issues with the house? Like, I'm really interested in how Cyril bought the house without consulting his wife. And then late in the book, you find out Danny bought the house in New York without consulting Celeste, and she always hated the house. I mean, that doesn't feel, you know, coincidental.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think that there are all sorts of things that Danny does that his father did, yes. that Maeve does, that her mother did, and that we all do that. We repeat patterns when we think we are completely free of them, when we think that we are the one who got away and we're different. And then you find out, no, look, I did the same stupid thing that my parents did.
It seems like one of the darkest moments, Elizabeth and I were talking about this, one of the darkest moments in the book is when Andrea takes the room with the window seat around, away from Maeve. Hmm. And the father is complicit and they walk up to the third floor. And that is when you think, All loyalties have been broken now. And again, it was in the house. It was the window seat that came up over and over again. And even later, when they were all grown up, instantly they returned to the idea of the window seat. It was so powerful.
Yeah. That was the thing I always wanted when I was a little girl. And I had gone into a house once that had that, the window seat with the heavy drape over it, and thought, mm-hmm. that's got to be the ultimate little girl fantasy. And as awful as it was that Maeve loses her bedroom, hopefully there's also the tiniest bit of logic in there, too, because she has gone off to college, right? She's gone. And Andrea's saying she's not ever going to live here again. This room should go to my daughter. And that seems both horrible, and yet at the same time, there is a little part of me that thinks, should the very best room in the house be held as in place for someone who's gone?
Right. Yes. So switching gears to the theme of forgiveness and punishment, a listener asks, forgiveness is a powerful theme of the book, and it was interesting to see how people would forgive the same person for the same damage done on very different timetables, and that forgiveness done separately can cause a rift in what seemed an unbreakable bond. Was that her intention at the outset of the book, or did that evolve as she wrote? It's such a quietly powerful and really wonderful book. I sat with it for a long time. And, you know, to me, that's a reference to Danny and Maeve and the forgiveness of their mother, and how that was such a rift.
I certainly didn't sit down and think, I'm going to write a book about forgiveness.
Yeah.
It's something that I'm interested in, and mostly how forgiveness is good for the person who forgives.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to not carry the burden of your own anger over the course of your life. And also to forgive someone, as I think Danny doesn't exactly forgive his mother by the end of the book, but he's come to peace with her. He's decided to put it down and to not be angry. That may not be the exact same thing as forgiveness, but to realize that the burden of anger is so damaging to the person that holds it. And I think for me, that's the theme.
Well, that came through so much with Fluffy, where his forgiveness of Fluffy was so beautiful and his kind of embrace of her. But was, I can't remember if it was Sandy or Jocelyn who was like, you really should see Fluffy. You're really going to feel differently when you see her. And he did. So he was really pushed into the position of confronting her. And then kind of all his feelings changed. And that was very transcendent, I thought, the way that was reclaimed. The past was reclaimed in that way.
And I think that's just the way it works. I mean, it's why if I'm angry at someone, if I can see them, it dissipates my anger, right? There was a family rift for several years in my family. And as soon as the person came back, I still had some things to work out. But when you can look and say, oh, look, there you are, you're a person, and we've had all sorts of beautiful moments together, the extent to which you can fetishize your anger, whether it's Danny and Maeve's anger against Andrea or Danny's anger against Elna, once those women are in front of him again, he can't hang on to it, because I think really no one can.
And then there's also the punishment element. Maeve seems really hell-bent on punishing Andrea as much as she possibly can, draining the money from the education fund to the point where she sort of makes Danny be a doctor when he doesn't want to be a doctor. Like, what were you going for with the punishment aspect of it?
Well, and I should also say her punishment is completely impotent, and she knows that.
Yes, she doesn't care.
Yeah. Like, she has to do something. She's got to funnel her rage into something, and that is the only thing she has access to. She knows that she's not hurting Andrea. She knows she's not preventing Andrea's daughters from going to college, anything like that. But she's got to have a vehicle for her anger. So it's a stupid kind of punishment, and she understands that. She is completely wise to it, but she also can't stop herself from doing it. And then I think that's repeated in a way of Danny's punishment of Elna. You know, he's not impacting anything, but he can't stop himself from doing it.
And then the way that Danny and Maeve deal with Elna, that really is the biggest rift they have.
Yeah. Right.
And
right.
And that's just this sort of dividing line. And we sort of, when we were talking about it, thought it's, and I think he says this in the book, that Danny had Maeve to sort of be the mother figure. Maeve had no one.
Exactly.
And so she really needed that. And Danny really didn't so much.
Well, not only that, but Maeve knew her mother, right?
Yes.
Maeve
yes.
had all sorts of wonderful memories, the happiest moments of her life spent with her mother. Danny has no memories, none of their mother. And he had not only Maeve, he had Fluffy and Sandy and Jocelyn. I mean, he was loaded with mothers who completely worshipped him and doted on him. And so why does he need this other person who he feels nothing but anger towards?
Now, there's a particularly beautiful passage in it, which brings up this issue of the past, which, of course, is a huge theme. So it'd be wonderful if you could read from page 45, where Maeve and Danny talk about trying to understand the past and their past.
And we should say that throughout the book, yes. for anyone who hasn't read it, once they're sort of forced out of the house after their father dies, they can keep going back and sitting in their car in front of the house throughout the years and watching the house. So that's what they're doing in this scene.
And I am, as I always do in these moments, reading from the wonderful large print edition. So, do you think it's possible to ever see the past as it actually was? I asked my sister. We were sitting in her car, parked in front of the Dutch house in the broad daylight of early summer. The linden trees had kept us from seeing anything except the linden trees. I had thought the trees were enormous when I was young, but they'd kept right on growing. Maybe one day they'd grow into the wall of Andrea's dreams. The car windows were rolled down, and we each kept an arm out, Maeve's left, my right, while we smoked. I had finished my first year of medical school at Columbia. It would be the summer we would quit smoking, more or less, but on this particular day we were still only thinking about it. I see the past as it actually was, Maeve said. She was looking at the trees. But we overlay the present onto the past. We look back through the lens of what we know now, so we're not seeing it as the people we were. We're seeing it as the people we are. And that means the past has been radically altered.
Well, and I mean, what's your answer to that? Do you think people can see the past as it actually was?
No.
I really okay, that's clear.
Yeah. Shall we just move on?
I
don't, and it has been proven to me over and over again because I think that I remember the past absolutely perfectly, but I have a sister, I have four step siblings, my closest friend has been my closest friend since I was seven. We remember the past with equal clarity. And differently, we were both in the room when it happened, and we remember it differently. And so there is no way for me to rally up the level of solipsism it would require to think that I was the one who was always right and everyone else was always wrong.
Right.
And I have to say, this is the first book that I have written in first person since 1994. My first two books were in first person. This book would have been entirely different had it been in third person because what we're operating on basically is Danny's perception and Danny's perception of Maeve's perception. But there is no room for Andrea's perception, the fathers, the little girls, all of these other people.
Well, that's what Alyssa said. Alyssa said, I would love to read the same novel from Maeve's perception.
Yes.
You know, you said that. Like,
I want to read this again, but all hear it from Maeve's point of view. Yeah.
And what's really interesting about that, and what's interesting about first person, is that the first question you have to ask yourself is this the kind of person who would tell a story? Mm. Or who would tell a story about themselves? Maeve, absolutely not.
Yeah. Mm.
Danny, yes.
But to the point, but to your point about this is what we know, that we are only seeing what Danny knows. And so many people said, just to be clear, Maeve is having an affair with Mr. Otterson, right?
Yes.
That seemed to be like,
yes.
Danny's clueless. He doesn't know that right. Danny and Jocelyn are sisters. He's missing a lot. And there's like this giant, and everybody's like, I'm not making that up, right? So we just, because so many people ask, it's like, clearly this is supposed to be a sign to us of Danny's kind of obliviousness, right?
Well, Danny's obliviousness, and also, I think that in a lot of ways, I have some deep buried anger towards men that I'm working through in this book, because it's so much about Danny's privilege and how Danny is so smart and charming and everyone loves him, but he does not understand the extent to which he is served. Yeah. And that all the women around him have little brooms and they're running in front of him, sweeping all the pebbles off the path so he never has to deal with anything. You know, when he says to Maeve, oh, I'm so sorry that you're the one having to go and deal with all my wedding plans because I'm so busy painting this apartment. Mm-hmm. And he doesn't get it. And it's something that I see again and again in life. Men who are wonderful, women who are shrews. And it's because the shrews are doing all the work the men cast on them.
Yeah,
which is why the men are so happy.
But it's interesting, like there's that moment of recognition where he said, Celeste missed her window. She was good at chemistry, so she thought she'd marry a doctor.
Right.
A few years later, she would have pursued chemistry herself or something like that. And she's like, she so badly wanted to be the wife of a doctor. That was so important to her.
And that's part of the trap of Danny, is that he is so kind that he appears to understand, that he can say something like that about Celeste, but he still really doesn't get it.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. Fascinating.
Coming up, more of our discussion about the Dutch House, but first this break. When you're hiring for your small business, you want to find quality professionals that are right for the role. That's why you have to check out LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn Jobs has the tools to help find the right professionals for your team faster and for free. LinkedIn isn't just another job board. LinkedIn has a vast network of more than a billion professionals, which makes it the best place to hire. It gives you access to professionals you can't find anywhere else. LinkedIn does all that while making the process easy and intuitive.
I know that when I've been hiring, it's really hard to do. It's really hard to find quality candidates. It's really hard to handle the process. Hiring is easy when you have lots of quality candidates, like with LinkedIn Jobs. It's so easy, in fact, that 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your job for free at linkedin.com/Gretchen. That's linkedin.com/Gretchen to post your job for free. Terms and conditions apply. There are some stories from our mother's life that I love to hear about. I love hearing about how she played with a tin dollhouse when she was a girl. And just in time for Mother's Day, I found the perfect gift that captures all her stories for our families forever. It's called Storyworth. Storyworth helps you preserve precious memories and stories from your mother and mother figures for years to come. And it makes a wonderful keepsake book so you never, never lose these wonderful stories and memories.
Here's how it works. Each week, Storyworth emails your loved one a thought-provoking question that you get to help pick, like, what was your favorite toy as a little girl, or what was your first job? All your loved one needs to do is respond to that email with a story. Long or short, it doesn't matter. Give all the moms in your life a unique, heartfelt gift you'll all cherish for years. Storyworth. Right now, save $10 on your first purchase when you go to storyworth.com/happier. That's storyworth.com/happier to save $10 on your first purchase.
So here's another thing. This is just, I am fascinated by characters, people who are drawn to voluntary poverty. And this is a huge kind of spiritual tradition. This is Dorothy Day. This is Simone Weil. There's many, many, you know, St. Francis. People who are drawn to voluntary poverty and kind of saint-like people. And this idea that it's very difficult to be a person in the life of a saint. That everybody else loves the saint, but it's hard on the persons who are actually like personally connected to them.
Yes.
And I was, and I've always been interested in that. So it was so interesting to see this person treated as, she's a major character, but she's really in a way not a major character. Just are you interested in that? And how did she come into the role that she plays? It's sort of like the investigation of the fallout of a person like that, who clearly everyone else in their lives is like, this woman is special. She's different. She has a higher calling. They get it. And he absolutely does not.
Well, it's very interesting, I should say, having this conversation where we're not saying, oh, this is a spoiler. Or, oh, we can't talk about this.
Yeah, no, spoiler away.
We're just talking about it.
Yeah.
So I am really obsessed with this. I went to a Catholic girls' school for 12 years. I still have a extremely primary relationship with the nun who taught me to read, Sister Nina, in first through third grade. She is 88. She is my life. She is my nun. And this idea of poverty, of giving up what you have, if I was the person that I want to be, I would give up what I had. This is something I wrestle with throughout my life.
Oh, have you read Orwell's Reflections on Gandhi?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, well. So I wrote this book twice, The Dutch House. And the first time I wrote it, and I wrote it, I finished it. It was a book about Elna. And it was a book about Danny having two mothers. So the first half of the book, Elna leaves. The father tells the children that she dies. She goes to India to work with Mother Teresa. In the middle of the book, they find out she's alive, right about the time Danny and Celeste get married, are getting married. Danny goes to India to find her. And the second half of the book takes place in India. And Maeve dies in the middle of the book when Danny is in India. Wow. It was so horrible. I can't begin to tell you what a flop and a failure. Half of this book takes place in Calcutta. And Danny forgives his mother and loves her and accepts her as a saint and brings her back to the States. And it was a bomb. But what I realized when I finished the book and when I read it and when I realized how horrible it was that women can't be forgiven for leaving their children for spiritual reasons. Men can go to war. We can have Ulysses. We can have Siddhartha. We have a whole noble tradition of men leaving their families for exploration of all kinds. And I wanted to write a book in which a woman had that.
Well, Pema Chodron, I've always been sort of curious to follow that up in her.
Yes.
She's an ordained Buddhist nun who went into spiritual life when her children were 13 and 15.
Yes.
And one accepted it and one, she said, had issues with it.
But she didn't just walk out on them.
Didn't she?
I think that she pursued her spiritual life. I mean,
I don't actually know.
Her husband left her.
Mm-hmm.
She had the children and then she begins her spiritual life. But I don't believe she just ditched her kids.
Interesting. Okay. Interesting.
But when I was upset with myself when I finished the book that I hadn't been able to pull this off. And what I ended up doing finally was I sat down in the middle of my office, speaking of Pema, on my meditation cushion, and I closed my eyes and I went up and down the street in my neighborhood. And I thought about every woman that I knew on my street who had young children. And I thought, okay, there I see Whitney and I see little Wynne and little Claire. What if Whitney left Wynne and Claire and went to India to serve the poor? And I thought, I'd kill her. I mean, like, again and again, what I felt was this
Danny
anger.
Danny raised that question right
when I really
Jocelyn
saw the kids, when I thought of real children with happy lives on my own suburban street and their mother walking away to go to another country, I thought, this is selfish and self-aggrandizing and heartless. And that I hadn't put that question to myself in the difficult way before I started the book.
So you kind of skipped that tension.
I did.
Let her off the hook.
Wow. I did, because I was operating from an intellectual point of view and not an emotional, not thinking, what would this actually be like?
But this is why I mentioned the Orwell essay, because he says, like, to be a saint is not to be human. And that at some point, what does it mean to be human? It means to love some people more than others. And he goes through a whole thing of, like, what is it to be a saint? It's fascinating, absolutely fascinating.
And then what is it like when you decide you're going to throw out most of your book? I mean, do you go into a deep depression? Do you take a few weeks off and just say, I'm not going to think about this? What is that like?
You know, it was really interesting. I had been away at a friend's house, an empty house, finishing the book. I came home. My friend Patrick Ryan, who is a writer who I love, and he comes and we work together every year for a couple of weeks. So I read the book and I go downstairs and I said to Patrick, the book's, it's horrible. I just got to the end. It's horrible. I have to throw it out. And he said, well, you know, let me read it. Let me read it. And I said, no, like, the only victory in all of this is that no one will ever read this. And I deleted all the files.
You did?
Wow.
Like that day. Like
that,
I didn't.
Wow.
I did not sit around and think about it.
Wow.
And
that
so
is
many
bold.
People said to me, but what if you were wrong? I'm like, oh my God, there is no way in the world I could be wrong about whether or not a book of mine was bad. Like, I own a bookstore. I read bad books. I know what a bad book looks like.
And how long had you worked on it?
I don't know, a year and a half, maybe. But I mean, when I finally got it, I wrote it in a few months.
Because it was so clear in your mind.
Yes.
At that point.
When I finally figured out what I was doing, I could do it fast.
Meanwhile, I'm sitting here thinking, you writing a bad book, I'm sure many of us would find it incredibly entertaining, even if it wasn't, you know, to your standards. I'm sure it was a great story.
It certainly didn't feel that way, because again, the emotional weight was off. That the fact that Danny just accepted his mother on meeting her, that Maeve dies, and frankly, the second Maeve dies, the book is over, right?
Yes.
Like, you don't care about anything. We just barely crawl through those last 10 pages after she dies in this version. She is all of the life and the energy in the book.
Well, speaking of Maeve, she's a type 1 diabetic. I'm a type 1 diabetic. So that was very interesting just to me personally. And Melissa asked us, she said, I was very interested in Anne Padgett's depiction of Maeve as a type 1 diabetic. Did you have a firsthand experience with that?
Well, my aforementioned best friend since I was 7 years old, Tavia Cathcart, is a type 1 diabetic. And so, yeah, it's been a part of my life. She's a fantastic diabetic in that she has just taken so much responsibility from the get-go. She doesn't just rely on what her endocrinologist tells her. She goes to the conferences herself and constantly is doing research and finding ways to live her best life and her healthiest life. So it's something that was near and dear to my heart, because she is so much a part of my life. And she worked with me all the way through the book and made corrections and said, you know, you need to have another scene here. Like, I didn't know that the scene where she has a crisis when they leave the house and they're in the car and she's sweating and Danny doesn't have his driver's license and he's helping her then. Tavia said, you need to put that in, because something that was so emotionally upsetting could have tripped her up. One thing that's interesting is that if you make a mistake in a book, you get so many letters about it forever and ever. And all the mistakes had been culled because of Goodreads, right? Because galleys now go out to all these people before the book is printed, I got so many corrections at a moment where I could change it before the final draft.
Fascinating.
At one point I say something about Danny's 3-point shot. Somebody wrote to me and said, oh, the 3-point shot didn't come in until 1978.
Oh my gosh.
I was like, that sort of thing. I got things about the draft wrong.
That would be so funny to just do like a little, like, thanks readers for the bloopers or something. Oh. And just do a collect, like all the words that you find out that you're mispronouncing when you do the audiobook. Like, you know,
so amazing.
It's so funny.
But that's a great idea. I love that idea. But I got a letter like 2 weeks ago from a woman who was a retired pediatric endocrinologist in New York. And she said, how's she testing her blood? Those blood test strips were invented in 1980. I wrote her back and just said, wow, I just bow my head because I cannot fix that. Even in another printing, I can't fix it. And you are the only person who's called me out on it, which is amazing.
Wow. Well, I really appreciated reading about just her experience. So thank you for that.
Can I say one more thing about that?
Yeah.
Which connects. In my book, State of Wonder, whatever was before State of Wonder, Run. So I was on book tour for Run, and someone came up to me in a signing line and said, I want to read a book in which there is a character who is deaf, and it is not a book about someone being deaf. Mm. There is just a deaf person in the book, and that is not what the book is about. And I said, wow, that's a great idea. And so I, in my next book, State of Wonder, had this character, Easter, who is deaf, and nobody cares, and nobody is talking about him being deaf. And I thought, that's so important. So that has really followed me forward. Mm. It's like, okay, she's a diabetic, and we're dealing with this throughout the book, but this is not a book about being a diabetic.
Right.
Yeah, and her death was not necessarily because she was diabetic. She also smoked.
And her father died earlier.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Coming up, more with Anne, but first, this break. This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. It can be easy to ignore our social battery and spread ourselves thin, especially with social gatherings picking up after the winter. Gretchen, you know I love to socialize, but I need to do it in a way that's good for me, that doesn't drain my battery. And therapy can really help figure out what works for you, what doesn't work for you, so that you're not just spending out too much of your social energy.
If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist, and switch therapists anytime for no additional charge. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/GretchenRubin today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/GretchenRubin.
This message is sponsored by Greenlight. When you're a parent, as we both are, you'll have your fair share of big talks with your kids. One of those big talks should involve money, and Greenlight can help with that. Greenlight is a debit card and money app made for families. You can send your kids instant money transfers, get real-time notifications of spending, manage chores, and automate allowance. Gretchen, we got Greenlight for Jack, and I love that it teaches him financial independence. Mm. He can earn money from us by doing chores and then getting money deposited into his Greenlight account. He can keep track of what he's spending.
Millions of parents and kids use Greenlight to learn how to make responsible financial choices. So stop putting off the money talk and start putting your kids on the right path. Sign up for Greenlight today and get your first month free at greenlight.com/happier. That's greenlight.com/happier to try Greenlight for free. Greenlight.com/happier. I was very interested because in the flap copy, and I know how carefully flap copy is considered, the book is described as a fairy tale. And I thought, okay, how is it a fairy tale? So there's the wicked stepmother who forces the children out of the castle.
And then is there a curse? Because the ending of it was, to me, so striking. 2 weeks later, Maeve died. And we're told over and over again that the father said, every time your mother leaves, Maeve gets sick. If your mother comes back and keeps leaves again, Maeve will die. And that happens.
Mm-hmm.
The mother comes back and she leaves mm-hmm. by going to take care of Andrea, which to Maeve is like the betrayal. Once again, you're choosing to take care of somebody helpless or who needs you more than me, even though I'm telling you I need you. Don't go there. I mm-hmm. can't have you coming and going from the house. And then she does die.
Mm-hmm.
Comment. I was just, when I read that, I was like, whoa. 2 weeks later, Maeve died. I did not see it coming. Mm-hmm. You're right. Everything after that just completely shifts. Danny kind of goes lifeless.
Yeah.
Well, how do we understand that?
You know, I don't think that it was a curse. I mean, I don't think that the father set something out,
or it was like a destiny. Maybe not a curse, but like a prophecy or a deep insight.
Or it's what Tavia was telling me, which was that severe trauma really can impact diabetes.
Mm.
And so is that a curse or is that a medical truth? Or is it somewhere in between? As far as the fairy tale thing is concerned, when I wrote my first book, Patron Saint of Liars, when I was 27 years old, Alice McDermott very kindly reviewed it in the New York Times, and she called it a fairy tale. And that word has followed me throughout my life. And everything I write is called a fairy tale. Although for me, it's Catholicism.
Mm.
But Catholicism is a fairy tale.
Mm.
Sorry. Butler's Lives of the Saints. If you read Aesop's Fables, Hans Christian Andersen, Butler's Lives of the Saints, you're reading the same book. And those are the things that I read as a child. I mean, I like big plot arcs. I like stories with morals and not magic realism, but there is a certain kind of magic that comes from growing up Catholic.
Mm. That's really interesting.
So there's a sort of fadedness that is coming into play or is coming to pass.
Yeah.
Yes. So it was satisfying in that there was a coherence to it or like a prophecy fulfilled aspect to it, even though it was terrible in its consequences. But it was kind of in a literary way.
Well, but, you know, as Chekhov says,
yes,
if there's a gun, a gun in the first act, it's going to go off in the third act.
Yeah.
And that's the gun.
Mm-hmm. But I didn't see it coming. And that's the artistry of it, which is it was exactly predictable. And we had been told over and over that's what to expect. And when it happened, I was like, what?
Yeah. But guess what? That's what death is.
Yes.
Every single time.
Yeah. Mm.
We know it's coming. We know it's coming. And it always catches us off. Yeah.
Now, we always do like to ask a guest for a try this at home. This is just kind of a concrete thing that you would recommend that people try at home to make themselves happier, healthier, more productive, or more creative. So do you have any suggestions for listeners?
I have so many.
Excellent. You've come to the right place.
Yeah. But I'm going to give you what I think is the most important one and is the reason that I am a writer, which is the thing I have that other people do not have. I have the ability to forgive myself all. Mm-hmm. And I think that that is the most important thing. The story that you imagine in your mind, if you are a seventh grader who has to write a world history paper, or if you are a 56-year-old novelist who is working on your whatever number book, what is in your head and what is on paper bear no resemblance to one another. Never, ever will they meet. And what is in my head is so beautiful, so moving, so important. And I cannot get what is in my head on paper. No one can. And when you read what you've written and you compare it to what you imagined, it comes up so short. It breaks my heart every time. And I think that that's what people don't write. They crumple it up and they say, oh, I'm no good. This is no good. But it's never any good. So you have to say, this is the best I could do today. And I forgive myself.
What's interesting, because we talked to Isaac Mizrahi, and he talked about going to an exhibit and how he had kind of almost a feeling of nausea because it filled him with a desire to do something so beautiful, and he knew that he never could.
That's right.
And yet you have to try.
Yeah. Every time I go to work, I am confronted by my lack of intelligence and my lack of talent. And if I never went to work, I would not have to be confronted by those things.
Oh, yes.
Wow. Yes.
But I do, I go, I look, I break my heart, and then I have something.
And do you have a discipline or a practice or a habit or a mantra that helps you to do that? Because I think a lot of people would be like, yes, I would like to do that. How do you do that?
Well, the mantra is I forgive myself.
Mm.
And also, you have to think of your brain as having two parts, the part that makes art and the part that is critical of art.
Mm-hmm.
Both are important. But when you are making art, you must turn off the part of your brain that is critical of art. You cannot edit and write at the same time. You get into this thing which I call editing yourself off the page.
Mm-hmm.
So even before you type the sentence, you think, well, that's no good. And then you don't type. So you say, I have to write. I may not pass judgment. I may not pass judgment today. And then tomorrow or 2 weeks or a year or whenever, then you go back and you look at it and you pass judgment. And then you edit. But if you try to do those two things simultaneously, you will fail.
Well, Anne, thank you so much. We enjoyed this immensely. It was such a pleasure to read the book and an additional pleasure to get to talk to you about it.
It was so nice to talk to both of you. I've really looked forward to this. And I appreciate you using your giant platform for literature and for books. That means a lot to me and a lot to the country.
Thank you, Anne.
Thanks, Anne.
Bye.
We'd still love to hear your impressions and reflections on this terrific novel, The Dutch House. Let us know on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook. Drop us an email at podcast@gretchenrubin.com. Or as always, you can go to the show notes. This is happiercast.com/283 for everything related to this episode. Remember, whenever it is and wherever you are, there's always a book waiting for you. And that's it for this episode of Happier. Remember to try this at home. Read Ann Patchett's novel, The Dutch House. Or if you've already read it, read another one of her terrific works, such as Bel Canto, Commonwealth, State of Wonder. Or if you like essays, This is the Story of a Happy Marriage. Or maybe my favorite, the memoir, Truth and Beauty. Let us know what you thought.
Thanks to our wonderful guest, Ann Patchett. If you'd like to order her books or any books from her indie bookstore, Parnassus, in Nashville, we'll post a link to the store and to all her books there. Thanks to our executive producer, Chuck Reed, and everyone at Cadence 13. Get in touch. Gretchen's on Twitter @GretchenRubin, and I'm @ElizabethCraft. Our email address is podcast@GretchenRubin.com.
And if you like this show, you know what to do. Please be sure to tell a friend and rate and review and subscribe to us wherever you listen to your podcasts. The resources for this week. Do you want a t-shirt with your tendency on it? Yes, wear your tendency with pride. Visit GretchenRubin.com/merch to order a t-shirt, sweatshirt, or tote bag with upholder, obliger, questioner, or rebel. And if you are working on your habits, which a lot of people are doing these days, you can download my checklist for habit change at GretchenRubin.com/resources. This chart will help you use the 21 strategies for habit change as you work on a crucial key habits. And if you want to know more about those 21 habit strategies, it's all described in my book, Better Than Before.
Until next week, I'm Elizabeth Craft.
And I'm Gretchen Rubin. Thanks for joining us. Onward and upward. So listen, I cannot believe that Ann Patchett threw out a whole novel.
I know. I mean, I wouldn't even want to throw out a paragraph.
I know.
Doing all that work.
She deleted the files.
Plus, I'm sure it was a great book.
Oh, I'm sure it was great. Wow. That's high standards. From the Onward Project.
I don't know about you, but I'm always looking for ways for my son to get involved and give back in our local community. That's why I'm excited to tell you about Student Visionaries of the Year, a campaign by Leukemia and Lymphoma Society, the largest nonprofit organization dedicated to creating a world without blood cancers.
Student Visionaries of the Year is a 7-week philanthropic leadership development program for high school students. Participants form strong teams and fundraise in honor of a pediatric blood cancer survivor in their local community. This program is transformative. It not only helps students develop valuable life skills like project management, communication, financial literacy, and entrepreneurship, not to mention it looks great on college applications, but most importantly, is also a chance for them to engage in meaningful work within their community and make a real impact on blood cancer patients and their families. You can learn more about Student Visionaries of the Year or even nominate a student at lls.org/students. That's lls.org/students.